I'm expecting to learn something here, okay? Because I don't know. That's right. Well, I knew Ken was here, so. What's the difference between work and play?
Need to and want.
Huh?
Need to and want.
So you need to play and you want to work? Okay. Okay, so we got the moral relativist here. No, right, so there's an aspect of, it's subjective. It depends on your perspective, whether you experience it as work or play.
I feel like it doesn't have a lot to do with how much you enjoy it, and more to do with what the purpose of play. I feel like work is usually to pay the bill. You know what I mean?
It's really exciting.
You might enjoy it, but it kind of has an obligation to be attached to it.
And play would be what?
I guess it could be fun. Where are we also missing?
Okay. Okay.
From science is old for exerting force to...
Oh, okay. From over relativism to science. No, you're right. I mean, what could be play for one person could be, like, there's the activity. It might be neutral to the activity. It might be the perspective. But over this side... What's the difference between work and play?
For children, not much. There's that fine line because they work out, or they're working in their play.
Yeah. Yeah, and children will play with utmost seriousness, won't they? Yeah. So it's difficult, isn't it, to try to sort this out? It's interesting, you know, to me when we talk about work, one of the challenges is that we talk about work in such a way that there's kind of burden attached to it, or frustration attached to it. When we come to this subject of work, I think the scripture teaches us that work is an act of faith. And when it becomes an act of faith, we recognize that it's not about you or me. It's not about us. And I think when we turn to Ecclesiastes, what we notice is that in the end, if it's an act of faith, it's something that participates in God and who God is. So let's turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and we'll begin in verse 9. Ecclesiastes is a part of the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, and what that means is that it's almost a collection of wise sayings or observations about life. So starting in verse 9, it says, "What does the worker gain from his or her toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on humanity. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of people. And yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know there is nothing better than for humanity to be happy and to do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his or her toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing taken away from it. God does it so that all people will revere Him." Word of the Lord. One of the books that I read to my children is the book I'll Be With You Always by Jody Erickson Tada. And I don't know if it's a true story, so just let's get the fiction and nonfiction thing out of the way. I think it's roughly based on a figure that actually lived in history. Yes. That's crazy. Okay. It's based on it talks about a young boy named Justin William Chase Jr. And Justin William Chase Jr. loved nothing more than to watch his father at work. Whenever he would smell paint and turpentine, he would know that his father was beginning a new painting. And so he would rush to the father's art studio in their house and stand at the door until his father noticed him. When his father inevitably did notice him, he would invite Justin in. He'd say, "Justin, why don't you come sit on my knee and pick up my paintbrush?" And then his father would take his big hand and put it over Justin's 8-year-old hand and begin helping him dip the paintbrush in the paint and mix the colors and then splash the colors onto the canvas. Now this brought great joy to young Justin. Not only was he feeling safe with his father, but he was also playing at work, playing at his father's work. And there was it was an experience of freedom and joy and power for him. Now, as he grew older, he began to realize that all of these paintings he had participated in, all these paintings that he had helped brush and helped his dad paint at various points, that these weren't just nice hobby paintings, but these were actually famous paintings. That his dad was actually a well-known artist, considered one of the great artists of New England in the late 1800s. And this brought great pride to Justin, a great sense of accomplishment that he was allowed to participate in this. And it's not surprising that Justin himself was also becoming a well-known young painter, so much so that he was able to get a scholarship to go study in an art institute in Paris. All because he had played at his father's work. Have you ever noticed how children play at work? Well, adults tend to work at play. So you see, in adulthood, we tend to work out of necessity. Various kinds of necessity. One is we need to put food on the table, and so we work out of fear for not providing for the ones that we love, or at the very least, not providing for ourselves. But we also work out of the necessity to feel important and valuable and valued, and so we put ourselves into our work as well. You see, work becomes something that feels corrupted to us because we have to do it. But in childhood, our work is placed in a totally different context. It's placed within the context of a relatively safe world in which our needs are provided for, where there's a kind of joy and a freedom that comes from the security we feel with our parents. And so out of this contentment comes a kind of play that is really work. We play at work. A realm of trust, our trust in the world and in our parents, leads to serious play. That leads to work in the same way that it did with Justin. How our children play is a picture of what the scriptures tell us about work. You see, the vision of work in the scriptures is not the corrupted version we tend to imagine, but rather, work in the scriptures comes to us right away in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. In Genesis chapter 1, there's the great creation narratives, and then when it comes to the creation of humanity, God creates male and female in his image. And theologians debate about what in the world in his image means. And it could be all kinds of things, but very simply, looking at the text, at the very least, it means that being created in God's image means that God has given us a calling, a job to do. You see, when God creates Adam and Eve in his image, he then tells them to be fruitful and to multiply and to subdue the earth and have dominion over it. Now, nowadays we're a little afraid of that text because we have over 7 billion people on the earth and we're living through an environmental catastrophe. And so we think we've probably domineered the earth enough, and we've probably reproduced enough, and there's that kind of worry. But the problem with how we have filled the earth and subdued it is that we have not paid attention to Genesis chapter 2, which is this intimate picture of God and Adam walking in the garden, where God invites Adam, the kind of subduing and dominant dominion that God gives Adam is the dominion of a gardener working in a garden, working and tilling the soil, taking care of that which God has created, working alongside God, would be a better way to say it, working alongside God to take care and till, and to allow the life that God creates to flourish. Human beings are given the responsibility of helping bring flourishing to what God has created. And then God invites Adam to name the animals. Now, God created, like, the amount of diversity that is created in our world is remarkable. And God invites Adam to help name the animals, to marvel at what God has created, and to actually co-create with God. So God gives us a vocation, a calling to bring flourishing to what exists, and to create alongside God, to help name that which God has created. And it's all rooted in this ecosystem of trust. Adam and Eve trusting the world that God has created. And the world that God has created, in a sense, trusting Adam and Eve. And it all works in this ecosystem of harmony and flourishing and life and trust. You see, in Genesis, we realize that we are created by the work of God and for partnership with God. We are the work of God, and we work, in a sense, in God. And what we see is that work is not what we do from 9 to 5. It's not our career. It's not what we do to get money. Work is not what we do from 9 to 5, but rather, work is the whole of our lives. And our lives are a work or a masterpiece. The work of our lives is our vocation, our calling by God to partner with Him in bringing life and flourishing to what He has created, to create alongside Him. You see, we work because we cannot help it, because we are image bearers of God. And the work that God created for us to do is a source of joy and freedom and power or capacity. God has given us the power to do what He's created us for. When Justin arrived in Paris, very quickly in this art school, he realizes that he's learned a whole set of skills that make him advanced among his peers, and he excels as an artist. And when he paints in Paris, he can still feel his dad's hand around him, in a sense, guiding his. As he works with the brush and he begins to explore his identity as a painter, Justin begins to develop a little bit of a following, and he becomes kind of famous in his own little circle in Paris. The critics of the art world are giving him favorable reviews, and so wealthy people begin coming to Justin and asking if commissioning paintings, asking if he can paint them something that they can put on display in their home. He receives accolades and he listens to them, and he begins to become proud and content and happy with what he's achieving. But with each new request for a painting, as his reputation grows, as he reads his name in the art magazines more and more, he begins to feel pressure. He focuses on his fame. He begins to worry and wonder whether he can actually live up to the good things people are saying about him. He wonders if he will become great and famous like his father. And as more and more people want a piece of Justin, his work becomes less and less meaningful. He begins to put more pressure on what he's doing. And as these things go, the greater his circle of influence becomes, the more people have an opinion about what it is he's doing. And there's some that like what he's doing and there's some that don't. They begin comparing him to his father. Oh, he'll never amount to his father. His father was clearly the superior artist. And Justin reads these things and he takes them to heart. And with each painting, he puts more pressure on himself. And it becomes about accomplishment. It becomes about reputation. It becomes work. And he finds it more and more difficult to finish his paintings because none of them are good enough. He worries what people will say. He worries about his reputation. He worries about living up to what others have said about him. And as he has trouble completing paintings, he has clients that are frustrated and begin withdrawing funding and begin not commissioning paintings. And his studio becomes emptier and emptier until he's another washed-up artist. What once gave him so much joy is now a source of frustration. It's a sign of, in a sense, his futility. Now, if we look at Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verses 9 to 12, it says, "What does the worker gain from all his or her toil? I have seen the burden that God has laid on people. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of people. And yet they cannot fathom from beginning to end what God has done." The very opening question in verse 9 is rhetorical. What do we gain? What does the worker gain from all his or her toil? It's rhetorical. And the clear sense of the text is that the answer is nothing. What do we gain from our work? Nothing. And the reason for this, the text tells us, is because God has placed on our heart a yearning for eternity. You see, we all know intuitively that everything we make with our hands is going to fade. We know that what our lives amount to will be forgotten in a generation, or even less. And we're not satisfied with that because God has placed on our hearts a longing for eternity. What we want is for our work to last. And yet, it won't. And so what does the worker gain from all of his toil? So we struggle in our work often against the void, against the fear of not mattering, against eternity. But this struggle is helpless. And Ecclesiastes tells us pointless. What does the worker have to gain? This came home to me a little bit when we were at the Dinosaur Museum in Drumheller in Alberta. And the Dinosaur Museum is one large exhibit to mass extinction. Because as you walk through, you go through one era of our, earthly past, and you see all these plants and these animals that once thrived that we see in our now preserved in our fossils. And then you get to the end of the exhibit, and it says something like, "And then they died." And then you go into the next one. And now the tectonic plates have shifted from one era to the next, and the sea's in a different place, and the mountains are in a different place, and there's a whole other set of ecosystem that's thriving. Then you get to the end of the exhibit, and they die. Here's a picture of a mass grave. And then we go to the next one, and it's on and on and on. There's in the entire history that we go through, there's no evidence of humans. There's no human artifacts till the very end. You get to the end of the museum, and there's a wall, and chiseled in the stone, which is kind of ironic that it's chiseled in the stone, as you'll see, is a saying that says, there's one thing we can count on, and that's change. And then, chiseled in the stone, it's kind of funny. So we hope that in like 1,000 years, somebody will find that and go, aha, something didn't change. Anyway, so then projected onto the stone wall from a video projector are some of the cave paintings that they found in France, some of the earliest paintings from the cavemen and women. And you see the dichotomy, or you see the challenge or the tension that we live in there. There's one thing we can count on, that's change. Our earth is always changing and moving and shifting. And what's important in one era is forgotten in the next. Even the tectonic plates we're sitting on are shifting. I guess my daughter keeps telling me New York is getting an inch further away from London every year. And yet we desire to leave something that will last in the midst of this change. And when we were living in caves, we would paint on the caves so that our children could learn something from that. And so maybe future generations could know something about us. And now we do time capsules and Facebook posts and other things that we think will last forever. Okay, so. We work helplessly against the fact that everything changes and fades. And yet God has put eternity on our hearts. The source of this burden that we find ourselves in is sin. And when I say sin, I don't mean sin as in sin in my heart. I mean sin in the big sense, in the sense of sin in the air we breathe and in the water we swim in. Sin as in a broken ecosystem of trust. You see, when Adam and Eve sinned, it wasn't just that they desired something other than God, but it was that they rejected the whole realm of God's care. What was desired, what they chose rather than God, is that they would become like God. That they would become, in a sense, gods in their own, become like God, become their own gods in a sense. And so they rejected the realm of trust that they had with God. They rejected the ecosystem of harmony, and they chose to become creators of their own world. And the trust was broken. And one of the first things affected by this broken trust is their work. Because when they decide to set out on their own and to make a name for themselves, which is what Genesis refers back to several times, humanity trying to make a name for themselves, when they set out on their own, God grants them this desire. And what results is hardship and pain, because they recognize very quickly that the world does not conform to their will or their desire. Adam would still be working the ground, but now the ground would not respond in the way it did when it was in the garden. There would be weeds and there would be droughts. Adam can't control the ground. Adam can't control the weather. Adam can't construct his own world. And Eve, in giving childbirth, now her body would rebel and there would be pain associated with childbirth. They discover that the world does not conform to their will, and so they become insecure. Their work becomes prone to frustration, and that frustration leads to futility. What does the worker gain from all of his or her toil? Nothing. But we have eternity on our hearts. And so this futility causes us to work harder, to construct and to create something like the harmony we have lost, like the world we have lost. And so now we work at work. We work at play with utmost seriousness. And we do so with an underlying sense of futility and insecurity. And I think today we have two opposite problems, and some of us struggle with both at the same time. That we have lost the joy of work, and we have lost the work of play. Because like Adam and Eve, we have traded the glory of God for the glory of self. Essentially, we have become idolaters, and this is why our work is pain. Friends, it is God who creates. It is God who redeems and restores. It is God who makes beautiful. It is God who lives forever, who is the source of life. It is God who is the source of love. God is love. It is God alone who is true. But we, in our attempt to be great, in our attempt to make a name for ourselves, we work long, anxiety-filled hours so that we might become the ones who create, so that we might become the ones who redeem and who rescue that which is hurt, so that we might be the ones that make beautiful, so that we might be the ones that make something that might live forever and last on or give life to another person, so that we might be the ones who are the source of love, so that we might be the ones who are true. In the end, workaholism, The incessant need to work and to keep going, is making an idol of ourselves, because we live and act as though we are the ones that everything depends on. And what happens if we stop? And when we make an idol of ourselves, we can't help but eventually become tired and fail. Eventually, we find ourselves outside the garden in a hostile world where work loses its sense of play, where work seems futile. But our self-idolatry, or our exalting of ourselves to the place of God, can go another way. Some of us immediately recognize the futility of work, immediately recognize that if it all depends on me, we're all hooped. And so, what we do is we opt out of the whole thing at the very beginning. And we thrive in not working. So we neither work nor play. We simply consume. We are a society full of consumers, which is neither work nor play. So we medicate ourselves with TV and movies and shopping. Or perhaps we construct false lives that look great on Facebook and nowhere else. Some of us need to learn how to rest and bring the play back into our work. And others of us need to learn how to risk. Launching out and working so that we can again learn how to play. And some of us need to do both at the same time. Because we work hard and we consume hard. But we all need to respond in faith to the creative Creator God who invites us to participate in His good and His lasting work. Ecclesiastes 3:11 says that God has made everything beautiful in its time. And this includes you and me. This includes our lives and our work. God has made everything beautiful in its time, if we would only let Him. We learn how to play at work by acknowledging our sense of futility and our sense of limitation. When we realize that it is not about us, it is not about you, it is not about me. And that our work and our accomplishments, our failures, our successes, they are all under and within God. All that we do, the work of our lives, takes place under and within God. And so Ecclesiastes 3, verse 12 to 13 says, I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his or her toil. This is the gift of God. Here our lives are a work, and our work becomes play. When we realize that our work is an act of faith, it's a posture of offering. Because the work we do, the shape of our lives, takes place within the God and under the God, who it says in Ecclesiastes, knows, I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing taken away from it. God does it so that persons will revere Him. If we would know and trust this God, the God who is the Creator God, the God who is the one who redeems and restores, and then invites us to participate or to join in with His redeeming and restoring work. The God who creates and who invites us to create along with Him, under Him. The God who makes beautiful and then invites us to create beauty. The God who lives forever, who is the source of life and then invites us to give our whole lives to Him so that we might live with Him and be a source of life and hope for others. The God who is the source of love, who makes possible our love for one another. The God who alone is true and who invites us into a life of truth. If we would know and trust this God, we could receive from him the gift of work. Because it is not about you, and that, in the end, is the gospel. God has sent his Son to work perfectly on our behalf, to live the life that we couldn't live, who then opens up a way for us to live the good life in God. For the work of Jesus claims and redeems us and our work forever. Because nothing that God does can be taken away. The work of our lives is an act of faith and of trust. When Justin's studio had completely emptied out and he was all alone, he received a note from his father. And the note said, "Justin, please come back before it's too late." Now, Justin assumed that this meant his father was dying. His father was old and frail at this point. So Justin hopped the first steamboat back to New England, greeting his father in his father's studio once he arrived. Justin said, "Father, it's so good to see you." And his dad said, "Justin, it's not too late for you." And kind of taken back, he said, "Justin, pick up a brush. Let us do a painting." So now the old, frail man stood behind his son and put his hand around Justin's. And they began to dip the brush in the paint and paint like they used to when Justin was a child. Paint began to splash across the canvas, all kinds of colors. And this became a moment of joy for Justin, remembering the safety of painting with his father. Remember the safety and the contentment of playing at work. And he was full of joy, and he felt free. And he began to realize that he was participating again in something beautiful, something wonderful. And as the painting was finishing, Justin turned to his father. He said, "Father, this is one of your best paintings yet. This is a masterpiece." And as he was saying it, and he turned, after the first time, he really looked full in his father's face. And he realized his dad wasn't focusing. And that over time, his dad had gradually gone close to blind and could only roughly see the canvas in front of him. He began losing his sight years ago. You see, Justin was still capable of playing at work and creating something beautiful. But he needed to rest. And he also needed to risk, but within the safety and the contentment of his father. He needed to let go. And for a moment he forgot himself and entrusted himself and his work to another. And in the process discovered something beautiful. The key for us, whether we over or under work, is to forget ourselves. To either rest, because it doesn't depend on you and me, or to risk, because God's called us to something more than being a consumer. Friends, it is not about you or me. For everything God does will live forever, and nothing will be added to it or taken away from it. So let us, in faith, learn to play at our work. Amen? Let me pray for us.